Welcome to episode number 271 of The Vinyl Guide. This is Nate, your humble host, and today we're going to be talking with a really interesting guy, Mr. Clint Walsh from the band Dot Hacker, and so much more. Clint has dedicated his life to music, touring and collaborating with a ton of bands, you know, like Gnarls Barkley, The Motels, Juliet Lewis and The Licks, Chris Verena and Tweaker, and a ton more. And today, we're going to dig deep into the history of the band Dot Hacker, a group Clint founded alongside Eric Gardner, Jonathan Hitschke, and Josh Klinghoffer. Now, it's been a while since we heard from Dot Hacker. Their last LP was Number 3, released in 2017. But just recently, the band released a brand new surprise single, Divination, as well as a vinyl tri-color splatter reissue of their first album, Inhibition. Both are available at Org Music, so head over to orgmusic.com and grab yourself copies before they're gone. Now today, Clint and I cover a whole lot of ground, the founding of Dot Hacker, his music career up to that point, the creation of each Dot Hacker album, including the How's Your Process 1-2 punch, the issues of being in a band like Dot Hacker, where all the musicians are touring and parts of other bands, the coming together and perhaps renaissance of Dot Hacker, and lots more. Now, what you're hearing today, right now, is only a portion of the interview. There is a much extended version available only to the patreon.com/vinylguide community. So head over there now to hear the rest of the interview, and you also get to see it. That's right, we've got a video version of this interview. And man, oh man, is Clint handsome. You gotta see this guy. The only downside is you have to look at me too, but I'm sure your gag reflexes will all deal with that. The video interview is only available to our patreon.com/vinylguide community. So if you like this interview, you like our podcast, and you want to hear and see more, head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, help support the Vinyl Guide podcast, and enjoy the rest of the show. And also just two quick bits of business. Today we are brought to you by the very best record cleaner in the history of molecules, the Groove Washer. Clean your records with the very best of the best record cleaners, the one I use every day, and it is super affordable. Ask your local record dealer for the Groove Washer by name and accept no substitutes. Or you could order direct from groovewasher.com and use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 for a discount. That's the Groove Washer at groovewasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. And also, peoples, we are brought to you today by AudiophileUSA.com, the online record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. AudiophileUSA.com has over 40,000 titles in stock, and you never have to guess on the condition. They are always in amazing shape. Many with shrink wrap, original hype stickers, or even still sealed after decades of storage. Head over to AudiophileUSA.com, dig deep into the website, search around, and find the deals. That's AudiophileUSA.com, home of the Holy Grails. All right, we got our business done and we are ready to rock. Let's get into today's conversation with Mr. Clint Walsh of Dot Hacker.
Clint.
Hey, how are you?
Look at you.
How you doing?
Good. Oh, hang on a sec. Let me look at your gear here. I'll have plenty of time for you. I'm looking at the gear really quick here. Is that a real Prophet 5?
No, it's a Prophet 6. It's one of the, you know, the new Dave Smith whatever's years ago.
All right. Well, you look, you know, we've got 2020 in our rearview mirror now, and looks like things are starting to look up. And I tell you one sign. Well, there's been many signs of hope, but one of them is that there's a new Dot Hacker song out.
Oh, man.
And it sounds like it's, I'm going to say, a start, perhaps, to a next phase of the project. Would that be fair?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
You sound like you don't know either.
Yeah. You know, it's the whole thing was done under a very different dynamic than kind of what any of us were used to. Mm-hmm. And then you add in, you know, doing it remotely, not being in the same room together, trying to create some sort of language or vocabulary that was able to be, you know, translated other than musically in front of each other.
Okay, so Divination was recorded separately. You guys weren't together in any way for that, no?
No, Josh had recorded a piano and a vocal and then sent it to me. And, you know, it was, I'm kind of skipping over a lot of the details, but essentially Josh sent it to me. I kind of put it into a world. Mm-hmm. And then Eric and Jonathan, I kind of put that then through communication with them, got them into that world. And it kind of all glued together a lot faster, well, longer than I thought.
It's a bit like the Beatles, Free as a Bird.
A bit like that, yeah. Which seems to be like the new norm nowadays. Like, hey, if you got a vocal, you can, you're done.
Let's go back a bit. Tell me about your background. Are you from a musical family?
No, not really. But I grew up in a town in Connecticut that had a really good... I took piano lessons as a kid and took to it. And then the town that I grew up in had a really good public music school program, music program for public schools. And I really benefited from that and played trumpet. Did well at that, and then had to, the saddest thing of all, to give it up because I had a mouthful of braces and starting in eighth grade. So then, so the guitar was next, and I dropped out of school and dropped out of college, moved to New York, lived there for a lot of the 90s.
How did that go down with the parents?
Not too well. I mean, you know, even still to this day, they just kind of say to me, like, music, it's like really as Marge Simpson as you can get. Like, music is none of my business. You know, they just kind of have this, I don't know what it is that you do and or how you do it. But
so they didn't have records around the house. Did you, you know, did they, were they even listeners?
My mother, no, at all. My father was very into Harry Chapin, Neil Diamond, Don McLean. There was no, that was the music in the house, but my brother and sister, my older brother and sister were the ones who really, you know, this is like 1980, 82, the dawn of MTV and New Wave. And they just were the coolest people and brought home, you know, all of the early alternative stuff. And just was, that just started me off. And so my very early memories were like listening to the Beach Boys and the Star Wars soundtrack and stuff like that. But it quickly turned to REM and The Cure and just and all that. U2, MTV really like took a hold of me.
Were there any records that your parents forbid you from bringing in the house?
The only one was I bought Eddie Murphy's Comedian record. I just thought that was awesome. My dad said, you can't listen. This has bad language. And I found the tape in his car 2 weeks later. So
did you talk to him about it? Did you say, hey, we could listen to this together now? Is that, or was that not an option in the relationship?
Yeah. And to revisit things isn't a good idea. So and then went to school in DC for a couple of years, got to see Fugazi play at a free show near Union Station. And that was awesome. But then, you know, moved to New York thinking that I was going to do something. But once I visited friends in the East Village in the summer of like 91 and was just like, this is incredible. What am I doing? So moved there, played in bands, started bands. Then I started playing in a house band for a place called Squeeze Box, which is this awesome club on Fridays. And I had drag queens for singers and just learned all these awesome rock songs and these fabulous performers. And it really, that was like kind of the beginning of like learning how to play specific songs and specifically, and got drafted into going on the road with a band called Psychotica. And my first tour, my first time going anywhere, and got here in the middle of that tour. By then I was dating somebody in that entourage, and then basically on that tour, and then ended up moved following her to LA after the tour. And then that was it for me. I've been here for 20, 21 years, and summer of 99, beginning of 99.
Well, I mean, in LA, that's kind of the ground zero for touring and recording and whatnot. How were you able to navigate that environment? I mean, it's a brand new town for you. Did gigs come pretty quick or was it tough work?
It was bizarre. It was a good choice over New York because New York wasn't, I guess, the scene I was always hoping for. And seemed like there were a lot of like small circles it was hard to meet people for me at least. And even though I would go to Coney Island High and play CB, I could play CBGBs a bunch. That was cool. LA was the kind of the place that made sense. And really, like, the relationship I had didn't last long when I got here. And I by the time I realized that I didn't know anybody, I was sleeping on a couch. I had met through the girl I moved out here with or for. I met a guy who was in Nine Inch Nails in the beginning, and he was starting to do a lot of production work and stuff. And then we became fast friends. I started working with him. His name's Chris Brenna. Mm-hmm. And then this was like in the day of the remix. Remember when doing a remix was like a big thing?
Yeah, it was its own album.
Yeah, yeah. So started to work more and more with him doing stuff like that. Then, you know, LA seems to be more of an open circle. It seems like everybody knows everybody here. And it's just like one giant circle.
So you go from that scene, from staying on the couch, to eventually touring with Gnarls Barkley. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What else was in between? What have I skimmed over?
No, not too much. Doing a lot of work with Chris. We did a remix for U2 that I still like hear at sporting events that my guitars are on, which is crazy. You know, we did a lot of remixes for a lot of different people. We did a lot of video game scoring soundtracks and themes. Yeah, it was great. That was the time when I really kind of became a working musician. I was able to like not have a, you know, a proper real day job. And then 2000 started to doing more touring with the Dwarves, and that was also like bringing in some income. And then Chris had a manager who also managed Brian Burton. And it was like, yeah, early 2006. And they said they're looking for a drummer and a guitar player for whatever reasons. And that's how I got in. Chris asked me to go with him. Mm-hmm. And then, that was like my first like, ooh, I'm getting a salary. This is like a, you know, I have to pay taxes on this gig. You know what I mean? Like a real gig with, you know, you pay unemployment insurance and the gig and the whole thing. Like it was official. And negotiate salary and all that stuff. But it was great. And then, yeah, I think I met Josh like that first day or the first week or something, because he was originally going to be the guitar player. And then something happened. He was playing with Sparks, I think. Mm. So he wasn't available. So I was in. But then Chris and I couldn't do a couple of shows that they already had booked because we were playing E3 because we had just done a video game theme. Mm. So Josh was like my substitute for that. So I met him early on and we kind of became fast friends and stayed in touch. But in the beginning, that gig was crazy. It was pretty crazy. It was fun dressing up as a stormtrooper. Like, you know, it was funny. It was bizarre.
Now, this is also at the height of that song Crazy. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I imagine touring at that point was very different than any other tour you'd been on. I mean, you're in relative comfort. You're sleeping indoors. You've got predictable meals. That's a pretty good gig, I would imagine.
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was great. Mm-hmm. Also, like, you know, before other things, you know, before time passed, like for a minute, it was a really cool, fun thing to be involved in. And, you know, I'm sure my kind of excitement about it was hard to hide. I just felt like every day we were so lucky to, you know, get to do this because I was used to a van and, you know, roommates in hotels and all that crap. And, you know, mm-hmm. that was not that.
Now you weren't the only guy from Dot Hacker on that tour. Is that right? That's where you met some of the other ones. Halfway
through that tour, Josh ends up replacing the keyboard player for whatever reason. So yeah, that was basically the beginning of the end for us. We just became thick as thieves, and it was like it was probably at the end of 2006 that we had, you know, we turned to each other and started mumbling about starting a band. And then I said something like, maybe we should just be friends. Maybe, you know, maybe it's just a better idea to be friends. And he said, no, that's why we have to do it. So that was pretty much the impetus. And then we tried out people. We were looking for the right people. And, you know, after a while, I just said, hey, you know, I know this guy, Eric, who I play in the Motels with, and he's pretty much the best drummer I know and a great guy. And he fit in seamlessly. And then once Josh and Eric met, and then Josh knew Jonathan from up north or from around, I think, Nevada City, California. And he came down, and, you know, after about a year of looking for different people or whatever, it finally solidified as that, I think, around 2008.
So you went from, I guess, being part of bands, but also being more of a side man.
Yep.
To this collective that I would imagine is a bit more of a democracy than a dictatorship.
Yeah.
How was that transition for you? Is that something you wanted?
Yeah, I think there was a very kind of, there was an idea that, like, well, we're all sidemen. Maybe we can, like, be in the band that we want to be in, you know, the kind of thing that we always wanted to be in. Mm-hmm. I think that was kind of the impetus. And, you know, we were excited. We got a rehearsal space pretty quick. No, well, not pretty quick, but we finally got a small space, the four of us. Jonathan was either about to move down, had been staying here for a while or whatever, but he finally moved down. And, you know, during this time, Gnarls Barkley's getting ready to, like, go back out on tour for their second record. And, Chris wasn't going to rejoin the band. So, because I think he was working with Marilyn Manson or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends on who you ask, but I remember being in the room and finding out that Chris wasn't going to be there. And I said to Josh, we should get Eric in. And then Josh at the time was pretty close with somebody in their inner circle and called and said, we have the guy for you. And, that was pretty much it. Once they heard Eric play, I was like, yeah, no problem. So point being, as soon as we're starting to come together, three of us take off to go tour with Gnarls Barkley.
Yeah.
So depends on who you ask that question to, because I'm sure John was like, I just moved down here and these guys just, they leave. So,
I mean, it sounds like a great idea in theory. You know, we're all very proficient musicians. We get along really well. This is a lot of fun. We're all very creative, but all of your day gigs depend on other people and touring. And as soon as you start something and start to get a little bit of momentum, someone's got this, I will say, financial pressure to go out on the road and abandon the rest of the band. Was that a difficult thing to work through?
Absolutely. I mean, I was the next one to do it because I was arguably the busiest, I guess, I had ever been at that point, at least playing live shows. And I ended up in early 2009 getting a gig to go on tour with Johnny Hallyday. I don't know if you know who he is, but
I've heard.
He's the French Elvis. Only pack, like, plays soccer stadiums, but only in France. And, you know, it was more money than I had ever been offered. And it was a bizarro thing. And I got to spend, you know, an awesome 6 months or a year in France. And it was a gig I had to take, but telling these guys, it was not easy. I'm good at doing this to myself, but I was racked with guilt over that for, I mean, years. But as soon as we started recording our first record, I was like, I got to take this gig because I have to pay my bills. Mm-hmm. So that definitely put a thorn in the band side. And then when I got back from my first tour, you know, I was gone for 3 months, came back. Josh had told me that the Chili Peppers asked him to join. So that was kind of like, I see you're having to leave for a few months. I'm now going to leave for a decade.
At that point, was there the understanding like, yeah, hey, I'll be able to do both? Because the Chili Peppers are a band that I think they make an album every 5 years. They go to sleep for a while, then they become active. And so I could see where there would be an understanding early on that, yeah, I could probably balance both. Was that part of the conversation?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think everybody, again, depends on who you ask, but I really wanted to believe that that was possible. And I mean, you look at the proof, like we made some records, but it definitely, in my opinion, changed the dynamic of the band kind of you know, on a level that I think is still, we're still kind of working out. Like it, you know, it's just kind of funny. It was something that I feel like we all kind of were expecting it to happen because he had been hanging around with them for years. And, you know, we'd heard little things here and there about the possibility of him kind of being more a part of their deal. Cause he'd like played shows with them, went on tour with them right around that time, like in between Gnarls Barkley shows and stuff. So yeah, it, you know, there was really we were really idealistic thinking that we could do this, but and the older we got and the more kind of like the charm faded out of it, we all realized, you know, we're adults and we need to make money, and that kind of chips away at, you know, how much you can invest in your soul in like keeping a practice space and trying to do it. So it ended up kind of causing us to, we all had to go find our own Chili Peppers.
Right. So the first album, Inhibition, and the EP to some degree, that was recorded in 2009, but you held it for 3 years.
What was the reason?
What was the discussion around holding off on releasing that?
I really can't specifically remember. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I know that like the mixing was done. I wasn't there. That was a whole issue. And I know that, you know, maybe it was fit. It was like largely finished, but needed to be. You know what? I can't actually give you an answer. It may have had something to do with like we didn't have a label. Maybe we were discouraged to put it out because the Chili Peppers had a record. I really can't tell you. I know that it was mixed and everything was finished. Jeez, I should ask them.
Because I would imagine you've got this band. All of a sudden, your guitarist gets this amazing gig. I think record companies would have been lining up to see what else he had available.
Yeah, I don't. I'd love to say any number of things, but I can't tell you honestly because I can't remember.
Okay. So fast forward to 2012 when it was released. Were you able to tour at all? Did Dot Hacker do many shows?
Yeah, we played shows around town. We did small tours. I mean, you could say over the next maybe 2 or 3 years, we toured with Cedric Bixler Zavala's band, Zavala's. We opened some shows for them up the coast. We opened for Blonde Redhead on a small tour. We got, you know, because Josh knows everybody, we got cool gigs. Like we opened up for Jane's Addiction when Eric Avery was back in the band. We were so stoked about that. You know, there were cool little things like that. We got to go to Japan a couple times. That was awesome. Mm-hmm. But never like really economically sustainable or even really offered because there was never that much time that anybody could really kind of, you know, donate to it, I guess you could say.
Right. And you, I mean, everyone still had all their own gigs, things that they were doing on the side.
Right.
And in 2014, Dot Hacker did a couple of albums, How's Your Process Work and Play.
Yes.
Were those recorded on the heels of the Inhibition release?
Yes, I think so. I think it was kind of like in between the first Chili Peppers record and the second one. And Josh had a bunch of time, and that's when we started to play a bunch and get those songs in order. But by this time, for, you know, several reasons, the songwriting structure, how that happened, the songs were largely Josh's.
Okay.
And, you know, and that was a definite, the first record, a lot of it we wrote together, like Eye Opener was something I brought in, and then the band, we all kind of finished it together. Josh, I had the melody, but obviously Josh wrote all the words. There were a lot of songs on that record that seemed to be more of the four of us in those moments. Mm-hmm. The How's Your Process stuff, again, this is just my impression and my foggy memory, but you know, we got these songs together and then we just tried to really work on them. But they never really got finished until we were in the studio. Certain things like just vocal parts or other kind of melodies were discovered in the studio working on them. And yeah, that was an interesting time.
It sounds like you guys had difficulty editing it down. Thus the two albums. I mean, look, they're about 30 minutes each. You could have made one album. What was the discussion about splitting them up into two releases?
Yeah, there's, I mean, again, depending on who you ask, in my opinion, I'll say at the time, I've never liked the idea of a long record. I kind of had this snobby old person's attitude of, you know, 45 minutes. If you're making a double album, make a double album. But if you're making a record, it should be no longer than a side of a cassette. Mm-hmm. And it's a very snobby opinion, but one I kind of hold firm to. And I think what really did it in was we couldn't agree on a sequence. And in order to kind of save these songs in order to appease everybody, I think it was Jonathan came up with the idea of making two separate records because we couldn't all agree on a sequence. Mm-hmm. Or songs to drop or to leave off. So, mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of the beginning of like the unraveling sort of, you know, what kind of led to us not really doing much over the last few years. It was just like, there was a lot of unforeseen things that started to creep up, including like just being able to agree on an album sequence. You know, we'd already done the hard work.
Right. Look, I share your feelings about long albums, because it doesn't give all the songs justice. You know, it's and asking someone to listen to something beyond 45 minutes is really asking for a lot of patience that most people, even today, don't have.
Well, The Wall is like one of my favorite records, but you know, that's a long listen. I wouldn't ask anybody to do that.
Honestly, yeah, I've got an opinion on that. I think it'd be tough to call that down into a proper single album, but that's a another discussion. But then doing the kind of the use your illusion kind of approach is, I think, sound. It kept everyone happy. But then we start to wade into the area where we touched on earlier, which is it sounds like it's a functioning democracy complete with all of its issues. Dot Hacker became this project that you wanted to all be equals and all have a say. And then now you're having difficulty agreeing on what that statement should be and what it should look like.
Speaking for myself, I was really kind of at the beginning of a long road downward. And I wasn't bringing myself to it as much. And with that, I think I was just kind of giving my power away. And in that, I think that kind of mushroomed the dynamic on my part. And then it kind of became not a democracy, probably because I didn't want it to be anymore, I guess, because I wasn't really having a lot of fun at that time. So
you weren't phoning it in.
It was just very daunting, you know, being in a band with somebody who, you know, you both play the same instruments, you both can, you know, you never really had a dialogue about who's going to do what, or, you know, just kind of leaving it open. And for the first record, it really seemed to kind of work without explanation. And then suddenly it became very interesting to me to like want explanation. And that didn't really help the group out. Mm. You know, the other guys all have their own take on it and their own, you know, issues with that. But I think people's own issues with it not being a democracy anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I think just speaks to who they were at that time. You know, Josh is probably under a bunch of pressure because he's in the Chili Peppers now. And
sure. Well, he's quite prolific. And I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, he's got, as being part of the Chili Peppers, he's required, it's his duty to bring his A material to them. Did you feel that there was a compromise when it came to Dot Hacker material around that time?
Well, if anybody was bringing in material besides him, you know, I would have a better answer for you, but nobody really was. Like, I think I brought in maybe one, a song called Whatever You Want, which is on one of the two of them. I don't even know. But
talk about a passive aggressive title.
I know, really. And I think that was like the only actual words I brought in too. I mean, really, that was like where I was at. Like, whatever you want, here you go. So, I mean, yeah, nobody else was really bringing in as much stuff or was like you know, by this time, Josh owned a couple of houses. We were practicing at one of them. Like it was, it had become very much like.
It became the Josh show, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And there may have been some resentment.
You know, I mean, I would say we all love each other too much to have resentment kind of set in. Speaking for myself, it just felt like, and I've said this to people close to me, it just made me feel like every decision Josh was making was like the best one, and every decision I was making was the worst one. And like you could say musically or philosophically or creatively or whatever it is, I just wasn't feeling confident in my own abilities. And there wasn't really a foil at the time to kind of combat Josh, and it just kind of, not to say that he needed combating, but there wasn't as much, I suppose, like creative tension as there, in a good way, as there was in that first record.
Right. Okay. Because it sounds like part of your superpower is to be able to maintain your post and to be able to be alongside someone who quite often can be shining brighter than the rest of the members of the band. You did it with Juliette Lewis. You're doing it now with the Motels. You've done it with Gnarls Barkley. But this thing that you created is now you're going back to that role.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, but I mean, it was, you know, I didn't know who Josh was when I met him. Mm-hmm. That he had played with PJ Harvey. It was a very, just a quick sidebar, but Chris Vrenna was working with a guy named Paul Leary, who's a guitar player in Bottle Surfers. Mm-hmm. And he worked with us on a bunch of remixes. And one time in like 2000 or 2001, he says, "Hey, do you want to come out? Bottles are getting back together and going out on tour. Do you want to be the second guitar player? Do you want to come out with us?" I said, "Hell yeah, that sounds awesome." Long story short, never heard about it again. Turns out, John Frusciante had recommended to them, "You should take my friend Josh." Mm-hmm. Josh got that gig. So funny that, like, what a small, weird world. I didn't find that out until we were, you know, having drinks in 2006. Yeah. But so my point is, while I didn't know who he was when we became friends and all that stuff, as I got to know him and meeting or hearing about people that he knows or associates with, it became, you know, very obvious that, like, he's going to get more attention in the band just right off the bat. And I could give a rat's ass. Like, I don't mm-hmm. care. Like, I'm, as you said, I'm used to it. I don't really care. It's my job. If he's my friend and he's getting attention, all the more great for him. Like, mm-hmm. I'm happy and I'm lucky to be his friend, and, you know, we're in each other's lives. I think like the Chili Peppers kind of blew that up, and maybe it helped blow that up in my mind. Like,
yeah,
okay, now there's people in Japan who know all about him, and South America and Europe, and, you know,
you see him on TV. Oh, they're playing on Mount Fuji, and it must be quite surreal. So how did it then transition into Dot Hacker number 3? Was that a painful experience?
Yes, for me it was, yes. That was very much a rushed record that I think Josh was trying to make. He was trying to make a record with us at the same time that he was making the second record that he made with them. And by this time, yeah, I was a little bit more advanced, or whatever the opposite of that, regressed from wherever I was at the time. Mm-hmm. And there were other frustrations, and I don't want to speak for anybody, but, you know, I'm sure that Josh was wanting to get, this is me saying this on my own, just from what I've experienced. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that Josh was wanting to have more of a voice in the Chili Peppers creatively, or at least wanting to be heard as much. And that frustration probably came back into the studio on us, where we weren't really doing much of a good job of, you know, kind of nurturing that and saying it's okay. You know, we're all up our own asses, and while Josh is trying to do a nice thing, he's probably putting too much pressure on himself, and while we're trying to, like, be a band, we're kind of the three of us are having our own issues. So it just kind of spiraled, you know. in my opinion.
Sounds like you guys need to hire that guy with the sweater that that came out in the Metallica sessions. So was it a bit of a shot in the dark? Was a surprise that Josh is, you know, he made this demo for Divination and you guys are talking about, you know, what the next phase of the band looks like?
Yeah, that was an interesting, it just couldn't have come along more organically. And on the heels of a horrible accident from a good friend of ours is involved in. Mm. After that third record, we nobody said anything to anybody about Dot Hacker for a long time. And my relationships with, you know, the guys in the band at times became strained. Josh and I definitely drifted apart in a sense for a while. And I needed to do a lot of healing and changing and growing on my own. Putting that record out was a big deal to me. That was a big boulder up a hill that I've been pushing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning of last year, right around this record coming out of mine and Clint Mansell's, our friend is involved in a horrible accident and he's in a coma and his recovery is slow at first, but he's finally out of it. And as a kind of gesture to our friend, Josh writes a song and, you know, says, let's get this kind of immediate friend group around us to all contribute to it. And our friend is a bass player and, you know, let's work on the song. When he's better, he'll be playing on this song. It'll be for him. Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, just a sign of support and love that we have for our friend and his wife and, you know, our friends. And by this time, Josh had heard that Berlin record and could not have been more supportive and loving to my efforts. And that meant a lot to me. It was very much an olive branch, so to speak. And it really, you know, his kind of extolling praise and support was great. And so anyways, he writes this song and he says, everybody's going to contribute. And, you know, Clint, why don't you just kind of, he's going to throw me under the bus. And Clint, why don't you go ahead and put it together? So again, it was like this kind of piano demo that I think he sent to Eric, and Eric, you know, recorded like a one drum microphone thing. And I think there was this understanding that I was just going to put it together and I would produce it. Mm-hmm. And kind of select who comes in where. And we're talking like 10 or 12 people. They're all going to record whatever it is they can. It ended up coming out really, really good. It was surprisingly enjoyable. We had an incredible moment where we played it for our friend who's now doing better than he has in a long time. And it was incredibly emotional for all involved. And then out of that experience, Josh had said to everybody, or to, I guess, maybe Jonathan or Eric first, like, what do you think about doing a Dot Hacker song, but doing it the same kind of way with me producing, as it were, which is a term that is a very subjectively defined, you know, it seems kind of like, you know, it means different things to different people at times, I think. But we got,
I mean, do you feel the weight of that word? Do you feel like when you hear of the suggestion for you producing it, is that a blessing or a curse?
Well, the last thing I wanted to do was get involved with Dot Hacker because I just wasn't, mm-hmm. I just needed time away from it and was happy I did that. And so then by the time this whole thing kind of came around, it was like, I just said, okay, well, I would like to do it, but I, you know, it would need to be with me as the producer, with me kind of having, you know, there's this idea in the band that, you know, one or others had mentioned, like, you guys need a producer. We need a producer. We need somebody to say no to people. You know, we need to cut, like, there was 1,000 reasons why that may be a good idea. And, you know, I was as surprised as anybody to have it be me. But I think at this point in my life, I've shown that I'm capable of it. And these guys are my closest friends. And, you know, I would have no interest other than to make them shine like the, you know, mm-hmm. like the stars they are.
They trust your decisions. I mean, the way I read it is, you know, if Clint produces it, it's like, okay, well, then it's in good hands.
I think, you know, yeah, I think that was
you're the steward.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the kind of the feeling. So, you know, Josh sent me we had a Zoom meeting. We said, okay, let's do it. But under this kind of guideline of I'm the producer and I have the final say, and I'm going to create the vibe of the song. We all love the same things. And I kind of made a reaffirmment to them of, you know, what I'd said back then. Like I was really interested in being in a band that sounded like, you know, New Order and like Two Boy Army and some stuff like that. I was really into that. I bought a Selena because I could not get enough of mm-hmm. that sound. And so I said to that, you know, Peter Gabriel, like I just loved all that stuff. I want that. That's what I wanted to do back then. I would like to do that now. And I think that, you know, they kind of got on board. And so I took a piano demo with vocal in it, and that was all it was. And then kind of made a blueprint with a loose kind of idea, like, oh, here's a kick drum feel in the chorus here. Mm-hmm. You know, that was probably the pretty much, other than like some muting of instruments at times, probably the only sort of instruction I gave to these guys. And through dialogue and learning how to do that over like this, mm-hmm. which is not easy, no matter who you are or how many times you played music with people, it was still a process of its own. And I thought it came out really good. I was surprised and excited and really, like, it was really a genuine surprise. Like, the last thing I would have thought was how it was going to be like this. But I guess it kind of started with, like, this is what I need to be like for myself in order to be a part of this project now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the guys were gracious enough to allow that, you know, allow me that. Mm-hmm. What kind of future it has, I guess, depends on the dynamic, how we were doing. Jonathan's in Nebraska, you know, people are just out of town. You know, how are we going to do this? Are we ever going to play music in a room together again? You know, do any of us necessarily want to? There's a whole bunch of questions you could ask because it's been so long. And I think, I mean, speaking for myself, I'm a much different person than I was mm-hmm. when that third record was released or made or whatever, you know. So that's it.
Well, look, you know, if Mr. Bungle can do it.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's just interesting that kind of healing that Josh and I have experienced in our friendship has definitely kind of aided in our musical communication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not interested in that going away anytime soon. So mm-hmm. it's exciting, but daunting.
Well, yeah. And it's good you're not forcing it, but Clint, I got to tell you, you know, you are living a dream that so many people aspire to do. Mm-hmm. And the chances you've taken and the bold decisions you've made have really been to your credit, and you make music and I'm not only talking about Dot Hacker, but I mean the other music that you make, is just to be able to do that is such a privilege, but for us to be able to listen to it, it's our privilege as well. And the band Dot Hacker, I thoroughly enjoy. I mean, I love the band. I get lost in the music. I get a lot of music. I get half a dozen albums sent to me a day or whatever. And Dot Hacker is a band where I put it on half a dozen times or more. You know, it's something that's kind of in the rotation of me and my family. And especially that first album, Inhibition, which I'm assuming to you is probably the, if you were to point at any Dot Hacker point in time, that's the one that you would point to, right?
No question. Yeah. No question. Yeah.
You know, I reckon there's still petrol in the tank there, but I'll let you guys work out the details.
Hey, I mean, everything you just said, I you know, it means so much, and I appreciate you, you know, taking the time to talk to me, and to even say that stuff means a lot, you know. So thank you.
Yeah, most of it's true. Okay. So let me ask you this: do you have a record collection?
A vinyl collection?
Yeah. Are you the vinyl, or are you kind of like, yeah, take it or leave it, whatever?
I mean, I was alive, you know, I was a kid riding my bike to the record store to get vinyl, but I definitely stopped when CDs came out like an idiot. So my record collection is you know, maybe this. And it's like everything from like Pac-Man Fever 45, like the You Look Marvelous 45 from Billy Crystal to, you know, all sorts of shit. But, you know, it's definitely like, you know, a dated, I think it stops probably around the Joshua Tree. It was one of my last like vinyl purchases.
Yeah, look, we were all there. We were all we were all wooed by the sound and the promise of the CD. I'm no different. I've got just a slightly more pronounced obsessive compulsive disorder gene, which means that I. So this divination coming out on vinyl. Mm-hmm. What was the discussion around that? It's like you created this song. It's like, okay, we need to put it out somehow. Let's do a single. What was that conversation?
Well, I think we definitely wanted it to come out on vinyl. I was really interested in having. I mean, I made the suggestion, but Eric's the one who did it. Eric's been really putting out a lot of great artwork over the last couple of years, and you know, I was hoping that we could get something out on vinyl that was some sort of physical representation of his work, and then. You know, there's the Inhibition anniversary release, and we wanted to kind of call attention to that. So we thought about a new song, and then maybe we could get a second song together before that time frame, that window closed, but that didn't happen. So I think Josh suggested, why don't we put on the other side, when we put the, you know, pre-production version of Divination. And that has basically the version that I was given, you know, at the start of all of this stuff.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here because the cover of Divination is by Eric.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a wonderful image. I have no idea what it means, but yeah, it's a striking image. In the projects prior to Divination, it's been Josh who's managed the artwork.
Well, yes. Eric, I believe, found the photo for... No, Eric found the artist who the snail nipple shots. Mm-hmm. Eric found him. We all love that. It's always kind of been between Josh and Eric. I think Josh did the third one. I think Josh found the artist for the first one. But again, I would say that was definitely like, I love bands that are like associated with visuals. I love all that shit so much. Mm-hmm. And I think, but I'm very not. I'm not good at any of that stuff. And it always kind of seemed like that discussion, while I think everybody wanted to be involved in it, it was ultimately going to be up to Josh and Eric. And then, you know, whatever that discussion becomes, it became, I think for one of them, Josh had the idea for the, how's your process? The one with the nipple, we couldn't show that one in some market, so he said, do you remember the Jane's Addiction Ritual cover?
It's just for people who are listening may not know what we're talking about. There's two albums, How's Your Process, Work and Play. One of them feature a snail, but one of them, I think Play, features the snail on a nipple.
Yes.
And it's interesting, on Discogs, they don't show that one. Is even Discogs, which, you know, is, I thought anything goes on it. But yeah, so I think people are very cautious about showing nipple in 2021. Amazing. What a plan.
What a great, I have to give it up to Josh again. That was such a great pivot. Like, why don't we just do that? I mean, we were all such huge fans of that band back then. So it was like, yes, that is the perfect chef's.
All right, Clint, thank you so much for joining us here on the show. Again, I'd like to remind people to head over to orgmusic.com. There you'll be able to get all of the Dot Hacker catalog. Inhibition has a very limited splatter vinyl run. I think it's like 300, 350 pieces or something like that. So get into that quick. Again, Inhibition is a great place to start on your Dot Hacker journey. They've also got the How's Your Process albums, as well as Number 3, but also make sure you pick up one of the 7-inch Divination green vinyl pressings. I believe there's, again, probably 400 or 500 of those available. Then it's gone. And it has not only the fully produced song on one side, but also the demo song on the other. Very limited, very special, and very cool artwork as well. All of that and more is at orgmusic.com. Follow .hackerband on Twitter. And Clint, we look forward to continuing to hear about the rest of your adventures.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, there we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Clint Walsh of .hacker. Thanks, Clint, for coming on the show. Need to remind people that orgmusic.com has the entire .hacker catalog, including that brand new limited edition tri-color splatter of Inhibition, as well as the 7-inch single of Divination. Go up there now, orgmusic.com. Grab those before they're gone. Also, if you want to hear more of this interview and even see the video, head up to patreon.com/vinylguide. Join our community and get the rest of the show. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. I beg of you. Send them out on Twitter, share them on Instagram or Facebook, wherever. Even leave us a positive review. Go up to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Sign in, give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10, whatever the score is, and say something nice. Make us blush. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.